Epilogue. What happened in Moscow after Volant and his entourage vanished from the capital, departing from Sparrow Hills at sunset on Saturday? It goes without saying that for the longest time, a dense hum of rumours filled the city and quickly spread to the most distant and remote locations in the country. Whispers of evil spirits could be heard in trams, in stores, in apartments and kitchens, in trains both commuter and long distance, and on the beaches. Naturally, the more intelligent and cultured folk did not take any part in the gossiping about evil spirits that had visited the city. Educated people sided with the official investigation. This had been the handiwork of a gang of hypnotists and ventriloquists, extremely skilled in their art. Urgent and drastic measures were taken to bring them to justice, of course, both in Moscow and far beyond, but unfortunately produced no results. The investigation dragged on for a long time. After all, the entire affair was monstrous. In addition to 4 burnt-out buildings and hundreds of psychiatric cases, there were also deaths. 2 could be named with certainty: Berlioz and the unfortunate former Baron Meigel, employee of the bureau responsible for acquainting foreigners with Moscow's sights. Both had been murdered after all. The charred bones of the latter were discovered in apartment number 50 on Sadovaya after the fire was put out. Yes, there were victims, and the victims demanded a thorough investigation. Everything humanly possible was done, both to apprehend the criminals and explain all that they had done. And explain it they did, and everyone had to admit that the explanations were sensible and indisputable. Consulting with expert psychiatrists, the detectives established that the gang members, or at least one of them — suspicion fell primarily on Korovyov — had mastered extraordinary hypnotic powers, giving them the ability to manifest false, displaced images of themselves while actually being located elsewhere. Moreover, they could easily suggest to anyone they came across that certain people and things were present where they were not, or, conversely, make people unable to see objects and people that were actually there. In light of these explanations, absolutely everything became clear, and even the worrisome incident involving the inexplicably invincible cat in apartment number 50, who came under fire during attempts to arrest him. Having convinced everyone that a cat was making trouble on the chandelier, Korovyov was free to snigger behind the detectives' backs, delighting in his enormous, albeit criminally misused, powers of suggestion. He was also the one who set the apartment on fire using petrol. Of course, Styopa Likhodayev never went to Yalta. Even Korovyov could not pull something like that off, and did not send any telegrams. True, Yalta's criminal investigation department insisted that it had taken in a barefoot Styopa and sent the appropriate telegrams to Moscow. However, not a single copy of the telegrams could be found, leading the detectives to the distressing but utterly inescapable conclusion that the criminal gang was able to hypnotize people over enormous distances and affect not only individuals but entire groups. What are trifles like planting a deck of cards in the audience, or making ladies' dresses disappear, or a meowing beret, or anything else of that sort? Any professional hypnotist of average ability could pull something like that off on any stage. The talking cat was also utter nonsense. Anyone with a basic command of ventriloquism could produce such a cat, and few doubted that Korovyov's artistry went far beyond the basics. Yes, it was he, Korovyov, who led Berlioz to certain death under a tram. It was he who drove the poor poet Ivan Homeless out of his mind and tormented him with visions of ancient Yerushalayim and the sun-baked, waterless, bald mountain with 3 men hanging on posts. It was he and his gang who were responsible for the disappearance of Margarita Nikolaevna and her housekeeper Natasha from Moscow. Considering the fact that Natasha had vanished without a single article of wearable clothing, the investigators came to the conclusion that both mistress and maid had been hypnotized and kidnapped by the gang, like so many others. However, the investigation could not find any motive for the kidnapping of a mental patient who called himself the master from a psychiatric clinic. Neither could the patient's name be found. Thus, he disappeared forever, known only by the dead name of number 118 from Block 1. And so, almost everything had been explained, and, like all things, the investigation ended. Several years passed, and people began to forget all about Volant, Kuravyov, and the others. Many changes took place in the lives of those who suffered from Volant and his associates. As for Stiopa Likhodayev, he would never answer the Variety's phone again. Immediately after his release from the clinic, where Stiopa spent 8 days, he was transferred to Rostov and appointed manager of a large grocery store. They say he is quiet and avoids women. Stefan Bogdanovich's removal from the Variety did not bring Rimsky the relief he had so passionately desired for several years. Following his release from the clinic and a vacation in Kislovodsk, the shaking, ever-so-old man, who used to be the finance director, submitted his resignation from the position of the Variety. Interestingly, the resignation was delivered to the theatre by his wife. Grigory Danilovich could not bring himself to return, even in the daytime. Dismissed from the Variety, the finance director worked at a puppet theatre in Zamoskvorechia. However, he no longer had to consult with the venerable Arkady Apollonovich Sempelyarov regarding matters of acoustics. The latter was transferred speedily to Bryansk and placed in charge of a mushroom cannery. Today, Muscovites eat his salted and pickled mushrooms and cannot praise them enough. Other people who abandoned theatre included Nikonor Ivanovich Bosoy, although his involvement with the arts was limited to his love of free tickets. Nikonor Ivanovich never visits a theatre anymore, be it paid or free. Besides theatre, he has acquired an even greater hatred for the talented actor known as Sava Potapovich Kurolyesov. So strong is his hatred that last year, upon discovering a black-framed notice in the paper informing of Sava Potapovich's death from a heart attack at the peak of his career, Nikonor Ivanovich turned purple and roared, "Serves him right!" in a voice so terrible that he nearly followed Sava Potapovich. The popular actor's death evoked many troubling memories. That night, with only the moon over Sadovaya for company, Nikonor Ivanovich got terribly drunk, and with every glass, another person joined the hateful chain of memories, Sergei Gerardovich Dunchil, and the beautiful Ida Herculanovna, and the red-haired owner of the Fighting Geese, and the Frank Nikolai Konavkin. But what happened to them? Please, absolutely nothing happened, for none of them really existed. The only real person in his dream had been the actor, Sava Potapovich. He existed, but the others did not. So perhaps Aloysius Mugarich did not exist either. Oh, no, he existed all right, and still does, occupying the very position that Rimsky refused, financial director at the Variety. During his tenure at the Variety, Aloysius has not been known to participate in any shady business, or any business for that matter. His only action so far has been to appoint a new bartender instead of Sokov. Andrei Fokich died of cancer of the liver at the first MSU clinic 9 months after Volant appeared in Moscow. Yes, several years passed, and the events so truthfully depicted in this book grew hazy and faded from memory. But not for everyone. Every year, on the festive springtime full moon, a man about 30 years of age appears under the lindens at Patriarch's Ponds. Red-haired, green-eyed, modestly dressed, he is an associate at the Institute of History and Philosophy, Professor Ivan Nikolaevich Punirov. He walks under the lindens and inevitably sits on the same bench where he sat on the evening when the long-forgotten Berlioz saw the moon shatter in the sky for the last time in his life. The moon is whole now. It starts off white and turns golden as the evening goes on, floating over the former poet Ivan Nikolaevich. Ivan Nikolaevich knows and understands everything. He is aware that, as a young man, he had fallen victim to criminal hypnotists. He knows that he was treated and got better. But he also knows that there are things he cannot control. He cannot overcome the springtime full moon. As soon as it approaches, just as it once did above the 2 5-branched candelabra in an ancient city, Ivan Nikolaevich becomes anxious and troubled. He loses sleep and appetite, waiting for the moon to ripen. And when the full moon comes, nothing can keep Ivan Nikolaevich at home. When evening comes, he leaves for Patriarch's Ponds. Sitting on the bench, Ivan Nikolaevich talks openly to himself, smokes a cigarette, and squints at the moon or at the all-too-familiar turnstile. He spends an hour or two in this fashion. Then he gets up, his eyes empty and unseeing. He always takes the exact same route through Spiridonovka, through the Arbat alleys, and reaches a corner with an old rickety gas streetlight. Turning, he sneaks towards a fence surrounding a lush but still barren garden. Inside stands an old Gothic mansion. Moonlight washes over the side of the building with a large bay window, and the other side is dark. The professor does not know what draws him to the fence, or who lives in the mansion, but he knows also that he cannot fight his urge when the moon is full. Furthermore, he knows that he will invariably see the same thing through the fence. He will see a respectable, elderly, bearded gentleman in a pince-nez. Ivan Nikolaevich always finds the mansion resident in the same position, gazing wistfully at the moon. Ivan Nikolaevich knows that after admiring the moon, the sitting man will inevitably begin to look around anxiously, searching for something in the air with wandering eyes. The man will smile rapturously, mutter openly and quite loudly, "Venus! Venus! Oh, what a fool I am! Why didn't I fly away with her? What were you afraid of, you old ass? Now stay and suffer, old cretin!" This will continue until a window slams open in a dark part of the mansion, and an unpleasant female voice will say,
"Nikolai Ivanovich, where are you? Do you want to catch malaria? Come inside for tea."
The sitting man will rise from the bench, shake his fist furtively at the closing window, and trudge back into the house. The professor returns home completely ill. His wife pretends not to notice his condition and hurries him to bed. But she does not go to bed herself. Instead, she sits by the lamp and gazes bitterly at the sleeping man. She knows that at dawn, Ivan Nikolaevich will wake up screaming painfully, crying and convulsing. And therefore, a syringe lies before her on the table, next to a bottle of dark, tea-coloured liquid. After the shot, the poor woman, who has tied her life to a seriously ill man, is free to go to bed without fear. Ivan Nikolaevich will now sleep peacefully until dawn. The same thing always drives the scholar to pitiful screams on the night of the full moon. He sees an unnatural, noseless executioner jumping up with a hoot and stabbing an insane, bound Hestas in the heart with a spear. After the shot, everything changes in the dream. A broad path made of moonlight stretches from the bed to the window. A man in a white cape with blood-red lining steps onto the path and walks towards the moon. A disfigured young man in a torn chiton walks beside him. They talk heatedly and argue amongst themselves, trying to arrive at some conclusion.
"Oh, gods, ye gods,"
says the man in the cape, turning his haughty face to his companion.
"What an obscene execution!
But please, I beg you, tell me it never happened."
"Of course it didn't,"
the young man says.
"You imagined it."
"And can you swear to it?"
"I swear,"
his companion says, a smile beaming from his eyes for some reason.
"Then that is all I need,"
the man in the cape cries out and continues ascending towards the moon, drawing along his companion. An enormous, sharp-eared dog walks calmly and majestically behind them. A woman of immeasurable beauty appears in the stream, leading a stubbly man who is gazing round fearfully. Ivan Nikolaevich recognizes him at once. It is number 118, his nighttime guest. Ivan Nikolaevich stretches out his arms greedily in his sleep and asks,
"So that's how it ends?"
"That's how it ends, my disciple," number 118 replies. The next morning he wakes up silent, but completely calm and well. His tortured memory fades, and until the next full moon, no one will disturb the professor. Neither Hestus's noseless killer, nor the cruel fifth procurator of Judea, the knight Pontius Pilate.